I want to welcome everybody back to the Fitz News Studio. It is time for the Week in Review. We've got a growing audience. You can check us out on Apple and Spotify. Don't forget that. But a lot of news to cover this week. We've got major developments in the case of Bowen Turner, the accused teen rapist out of Orangeburg, South Carolina. Some incredible news in that front, both as it relates to the criminal side of his case and the political fallout from his saga. We've also got a story coming out of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Brittany Drexel, teen who disappeared back in 2009. There is a major update in her case and a potential resolution of one of the most notorious unsolved mysteries in South Carolina history. We also are going to take a look at the legislative session in South Carolina this past year, which shouldn't take very long because they didn't get much done. But we're going to go through the particular big ticket issues and talk about what passed, what didn't, who's to blame for it. And last but not least, we did have a bit of Murdoch Murders news. We're going to provide an update on that and tease a little bit on the news to come. All that and more headed your way on the Week in Review. So we're going to start this week with the saga of Bowen Turner, the fortunate son from Orangeburg, South Carolina. He's been in national headlines after he received a controversially lenient sentence from South Carolina Circuit Court Judge Markley Dennis last month. Now, Turner, accused of raping three different girls over a period of a little over a year. His story has been a case study for literally everything that's wrong with South Carolina's criminal justice system, its judicial system. Turner should have been locked up long ago, folks. He was violating his bond habitually on more than 50 occasions. It's a case study in exactly why our ankle monitoring is a joke in South Carolina, why our bond system is a joke. And now we're going to find out whether our probation system is a joke, because here's what's happened. Bowen Turner, who was again put on probation instead of facing jail time in connection with these three alleged sexual assaults, literally less than a month after this controversial sentence is doled out, you would think this kid would get the message, wait a minute, maybe I should straighten up, maybe I should fly right. Bowen Turner did not get that message, folks. Mother's Day, last Sunday, Mother's Day, Bowen Turner goes to a bar in Orangeburg, South Carolina's hometown, spends $100 worth of alcohol, puts it on a credit card, uses a fake ID to get this, because again, he's only 19 years old, right? Gets hammered, allegedly, and attempts to get a female employee at the bar to drive him home. And I want to come back to that, because to me, that's kind of the most jarring part of this, okay? It's a guy already accused of three sexual assaults, trying to get somebody to take him home, a female employee at this bar. But luckily for this girl, she resisted Bowen Turner. She didn't fall for his advance. So he ends up walking down the street in Orangeburg, stumbling, staggering, according to a police incident report. Initially, when he's stopped by law enforcement, he tells them that he was at a bar, but realizes, wait a minute, I'm on probation. I'm not allowed to drink. I shouldn't be at a bar. Changes his story, according to the arresting deputy, tells him he was in the woods. Well, eventually, after being read his Miranda rights, Bowen Turner confessed that he was at the bar. Yes, he purchased over $100 worth of alcohol with a fake ID. Now, initially, he was only charged with disorderly conduct. But since then, he has been subsequently charged with drinking underage first, and also charged with threatening a public official, because apparently when Bowen Turner was taken into the Orangeburg-Calhoun Detention Center and told that he needed to wear a mask because of COVID protocols, he told the deputy he was going to bite their finger off. Classy guy, folks, classy guy. So where do we stand with this case? Well, as I mentioned, it's going to be a real test case, and I want to point out something real quick here. Bowen Turner is in jail. He has not been given bond or not been released on bond related to these new charges. In fact, he is going to be held and detained until June 8, when there will be a hearing as to whether or not he violated his probation, the terms of his probation, which frankly, pretty obvious. He's not supposed to drink, can't get arrested. So both of those things have now happened. Obviously, if he's convicted on any of these counts, that would be a violation of his probation. But a big hearing coming up on June 8 in the Bowen Turner case, and we're going to find out a couple things. Number one, we're going to find out if Bowen Turner is still represented by State Senator Brad Hutto. Brad Hutto, the architect, we believe, of this controversial plea deal that Bowen Turner got, a powerful guy. He's the Senate minority leader. one of the most powerful guys in the state house in Columbia. And we believe that it was his influence that helped get Bowen Turner this controversial lenient deal. But Hutto has come under fire, and rightfully so, in recent weeks. And not just for his negotiation of this plea deal for his client, but also the way that he represented his client. And I've always said, look, everyone's entitled to a good defense, the best defense they can buy, in fact. That's a constitutional right. I don't dispute that. And so I don't really judge, don't often judge, Palmetto State lawmakers or attorneys or lawyer legislators for the clients they take, okay? Because I believe everyone has a right to the best defense they can buy. But the way that they advocate, the way that they fight for their clients, sometimes they cross the line. And in this case, Brad Hutto has crossed the line. And I'm referring to specifically to the fact that he slut-shamed one of Turner's victims in open court. And you notice I didn't say alleged victim there because Turner has actually pled guilty to a simple assault charge related to this victim. And her name is Chloe Best, and we're going to talk more about her as this show goes on. But I wanted to make point that out because Hutto is under tremendous pressure from within his law firm to drop this case. And again, I don't think that he's been told specifically you need to drop it. You don't really go to a Senate minority leader and tell him he has to do it. But I'm told his law partners, others in the firm and in the community have made it very clear to him they do not want him on this case. This case has been bad for their business. And you know what? Good. Good. That is the marketplace at work, people. That is folks recognizing bad conduct, holding people accountable in the marketplace. And so that's good news. Also, some accountability for Hutto on the political front. I want to talk about this a little bit. This is important. Earlier this month, State Senator Mia McLeod, who is running for governor of South Carolina, she's one of the two top Democratic contenders for this seat. In fact, she's projected to go head-to-head with Joe Cunningham, a former congressman. Mia McLeod announced earlier this month that she had been endorsed by Brad Hutto in her race against Cunningham. And guess what, folks? That sparked outrage. In fact, after our news director, Mandy Matney, tweeted it, drawing attention to this controversial endorsement, guess what Mia McLeod did? She took it down. She removed it from the web. Well, guess what? We got a screen cap of it, and a lot of other folks got a screen cap of it. So Brad Hutto is continuing to face heat over that, and Mia McLeod, by extension, facing heat for having him endorse her candidacy. So those are all important things to keep track of because those are market consequences and political consequences for what he's done here. And again, it's not just representing this guy, but the way he's done it, the way that he has essentially attacked victims, re-victimized them, just like our court system. So I think that's an important part of this process, but there's a couple other things I wanted to address as it relates to the Bowen Turner story. Something that I think everybody needs to be focused on as this case continues to advance. And I'm not just talking about Bowen Turner and his June 8 hearing regarding violation of his probation. I'm talking about the much bigger picture of victims' rights, of public safety, and how do we reform our judicial system, our injustice system, as I've taken to calling it, unfortunately. How do we fix it? Well, any reform has to include a number of different things, and I'm talking about sentencing reform. We're letting violent criminals go with nothing, people. Time served, time on the ankle monitor. In fact, the South Carolina House of Representatives, which is supposed to be controlled by tough-on-crime Republicans, they passed a bill this session, which would let people get credit for the time they spend on an ankle monitor. So from the moment you're arrested, as long as you're on an ankle monitor, which, by the way, we learned in the Bowen Turner case, nobody's monitoring. Basically, you get to run free and get credit for time served. That's a travesty, folks. And not only do we need to undo that, we need to go in the other direction. So I'm talking about bond reform that holds violent criminals in jail, sentencing reform, which makes sure they stay there, okay? But the biggest reform that we have to address is how we pick our judges. Because right now in South Carolina, politicians like Brad Hutto and numerous other legislative leaders, lawyer legislators, they are gaming the system. And we've talked about it on this show several times, but we see it every day. We see it in cases every day. And it's not just high-profile cases like Bowen Turner. So we have got to fix that process. And that's going to be the hardest thing, folks. It's going to be tough to fix the bond. It's going to be tough to fix the sentences. But those are doable things. Those are things that we don't necessarily have to take power away from lawmakers to do that. But getting lawmakers to give up the power that they currently have over the judiciary, that's going to be very tough, people, because again, these lawyers, they're relying on that. That's how they get clients. That's how they get paid, the advantage that they have over the judicial system. Putting a stop to that takes money out of their pocket. It goes against their self-interest, goes against their influence. So that reform is going to be incredibly hard. But if the last few years have proven anything, if the Bowen Turner case, the Murdoch case, all these other murderers literally let go with no bond, who kill again, if these cases have taught us nothing, it's that we cannot wait to make that change in judicial selection. And so at the very top of the list, at the very top of the list for fixing this broken system is fixing the people who appoint it. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about that in the context of the victims rally that we attended this week on the Bowen Turner case. So let's turn to that now. So 2 days ago, this news outlet went to the South Carolina State House to participate in a rally sponsored by a pair of groups that have been fighting for a long time for victims in South Carolina. I'm talking about the South Carolina Victims Assistance Network and the South Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. These two groups and their leaders sponsored a rally at the State House centered around the Bowen Turner case, reiterating calls for some of the reforms that I just spoke about a moment ago. Now, I'm kind of a jaded, hard-edged critic. I've been involved in this process for a long time, so it takes a lot, you know, to kind of hit that center of me, of to kind of get to something that touches me on a elemental, personal level. And I got to say, this event did that and then some. This was just a moving gathering, people. It was, I can barely put it into words what it meant to see these folks step up and finally to challenge this system, because this just wasn't a typical victims event by any stretch of the imagination. This was a raw, exposed nerve, people. This was a call to arms, to be honest. It was a challenge the likes of which I don't think the South Carolina General Assembly has ever seen from a group of families, that what they've been through. Most people would be intimidated by a system like this that clearly is not responding, clearly is not helping them, clearly is not serving them or fighting for justice for them. A lot of people would be intimidated when they're told to sit down and just take it. But I will tell you this, the family of Chloe Bess, Chloe herself, and the family of Dallas Stoller, they are not sitting down. And I wanted to go to this event, not only to support what they're doing, but I wanted to go to the event because these families, in addition to being passionate advocates, not only for themselves, but for countless other victims across South Carolina, now and in the future, they are also incredibly articulate advocates for the very sort of changes that are long overdue in South Carolina and are vitally necessary for us to implement moving forward if we're going to have any chance of a system that starts putting victims back in the driver's seat. So I wanted to look at a couple of these clips from this press, from this rally, because I think they speak not only to the hearts of these people and the experiences, the horrific, traumatic experiences that they've experienced, but more importantly, to the substantive policy changes that are, as I mentioned, vital if we're going to fix this. So I wanted to cut first to Chloe Bess, one of Bowen Turner's victims. And again, I say victim because he has actually pleaded guilty to a charge in connection with assaulting her. And I wanted to listen to Chloe first. Let's take a listen to her from this press rally.
The most traumatic night of my life has been drug out for 3 years. I put my faith in a system to help me, and I believed they would. Instead, they completely failed me. They failed Dallas, and I'm positive many others. My case is a ripple effect because of the failure of the previous two cases with the same perpetrator. When are things going to change? Why do these people keep getting away with making excuses for criminals? Who is not doing their job, and why do they still hold power? Being aware that I am not the only one, why was a state South Carolina senator allowed to publicly slut-shame me in court? Perhaps when your client is guilty, the only defense is to attack the victim. I am disgusted by the way things were handled. I'm not the one who did anything wrong, so I've always wondered why I was treated like I did. The senator stated that I never said no, but I can guarantee I never said yes, and I have the scars to prove it. What happened to me that night does not define me, but it does haunt me. However, it also motivates me to speak out and encourage other victims to stand up. We can't keep allowing victims to be treated this way. All it's doing is showing the perpetrator they can get away with it time after time, and it's evident, particularly in this case. No one can change what happened, but they were supposed to help me. Unfortunately, with Dallas no longer with us, it is our responsibility to keep her story out there, and I will not be silenced. Enough is enough. If you are a victim, it is so important to find your voice. Without it, horrible things like this will continue to happen. We have to stand together and fight for change. We have to stand up against big broken systems and push back against big powerful bullies, and that's going to take all of us.
So again, incredibly compelling there. And what I find most compelling about that is Chloe Best calling attention not only to her, the man who assaulted her, but the system that re-victimized her. That is incredibly important. You heard it directly from her. Folks, this isn't somebody pontificating from the outside, talking about this as a process issue. This is someone who was victimized by the very system that's supposed to protect her. And it's just incredibly powerful to hear it coming first person from someone who's gone through what Chloe Best has gone through. I just, hats off to her, just tremendous courage. Also, I wanted to draw attention to some remarks from her father, Dr. Darren Best. Now, Darren is a pastor. We've spoken with him, interviewed him on numerous occasions over the last few weeks, and he has just emerged as one of the foremost advocates for the policy changes that are necessary. And I wanted to cut to some of his remarks at this rally because I think he really hit on some of the reforms that, again, we have got to pass now if we're ever going to see a system that protects public safety. Let's hear what Dr. Best had to say.
Here's the thought today. Maybe if we punished violent crimes and we enforced the laws and did not plea bargain them away, we'd have less rape and violent crime. Thank you. The incestuous injustice system, corruption, nepotism led by South Carolina lawyer legislatures stand in the way of keeping the citizens of South Carolina safe. If I have learned anything throughout this process, it is when powerful people bargain with those who desire power, the masses, we the people, lose power. Or maybe it's better said that when the elephants in the room fornicate, the mice get stepped on. Friends, enough is enough. It's time for change in South Carolina. God bless you all.
So you see, Dr. Best gets to the very heart of two of the biggest problems. Again, the lack of monitoring of these violent criminals and the broken judicial selection process, which leads to these lenient judges who put the rights and the best interests of criminals ahead of the rights and the best interests of victims and of public safety. Now, last but absolutely not least, I want to talk about Brett Tabatabai. Now, Brett is the sister of Dallas Stoller, and she has been the most passionate advocate in this case. And Brett is making a name for herself with just her ferocity, her relentlessness, and her address at this rally, I think, was the most inspiring, certainly as far as watching how at the beginning of her remarks she struggled. She wasn't quite collected at the beginning, but the crowd encouraged her, and watching her sort of feel that power and then launch into her remarks, which were just an outright condemnation of the broken status quo in the state. And I'm telling you, folks, it was something to behold. And I want to cut now to Brett's comments. And let's take a look at what she had to say.
Hi, my name is Brett. Thank you all for being here today. As Sarah said, I'm the older sister of Dallas Dollar. In October of 2018, Dallas was sexually assaulted. I'm so sorry. In October of 2018, Dallas was sexually assaulted. For 3 years after her attack, Dallas suffered severe mental anguish, not only from the trauma of her assault, the trauma of being relentlessly bullied by peers and adults in the community, the trauma of hearing one of your very own state senators slut shame one of her fellow victims, the trauma of a system that repeatedly failed her over and over again, a system that has bred generations of women to believe that their voice and their story doesn't matter. On November 14th, 2021, Dallas lost her life. My parents lost a child. We lost our sister. And the world lost a bright young girl with mountains of potential. 5 months after her passing, we sat on a Zoom call with a solicitor who told us that they were dropping her case, that she wasn't here to say it was not consensual, because it wasn't worth their time or the taxpayers' money. Dallas had given sworn statements. She had a witness. She had plenty of evidence to move forward. Does it make it harder? Absolutely. Does it make it impossible? No. But they silenced her, as they have countless other victims. So what do we do when the oppressors are the very leaders who are supposed to protect these girls and these women and our victims, who are supposed to fight for them? We fight. We stand for the silence. We make noise, and we don't stop until we are heard. We vote the good old boys out. Every victim deserves a voice, and we are their voice. We are Dallas's voice now, and we will be heard. Bill Weeks, your move. Thank you.
All right, so the sound you just heard there, folks, was a gauntlet being thrown down on the steps of the South Carolina State House, and the question now is who's going to pick it up? Now, there were several state senators who attended this rally, and one of them, Katrina Sheely from Lexington County, South Carolina, actually spoke at the event. And in her remarks, Senator Sheely vowed to do whatever it takes to pass the legislation that's necessary to fix this broken system. We plan on holding her to that, folks. We plan on holding her to that. And not only Senator Sheely, who has been one of the few members of the General Assembly who has demonstrated a desire to reform the system. A lot of them are lawyer legislators, again, who benefit from the system. Senator Sheely's not one of those. She has been a victim's advocate, one of the best in the legislature, but she is facing a tremendous challenge of getting enough lawmakers on board to pass meaningful change. And again, I'm not talking about let's just make victims reform an issue this year. Like so many issues get glossed over. They get a little tweak here and there. Lip service gets paid to them and a meaningless bill gets passed. No, no, that cannot happen in this system because as we have seen with the Bowen Turner case, with the Murdoch case, and countless of other cases involving violent criminals who are set free back on the street with little or no bond and who are then given slaps on the wrist for crimes that literally wreck people's lives, wreck families' lives, destroy communities, and they're just let go to wreak more havoc. That must stop. As Dr. Best said in his remarks, enough is enough. And it's going to be up to Senator Sheely and other lawmakers to make sure we pass a bill that fixes the problem and doesn't just kick the can down the road. So one of the most famous unsolved mysteries in South Carolina history is on the verge of being solved. The saga of Brittany Drexel, 17-year-old New York teenager who went missing from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina on April 25th, 2009. There may be a breakthrough in this case, folks. As we reported earlier this week, Georgetown County Sheriff's deputies are on the verge of making an arrest in this case. And there's a press conference that has been called for this coming Monday, at which point Georgetown County Sheriff Carter Weaver is going to announce what's been transpiring amongst the various law enforcement agencies there in his county over the last few days. This case has attracted a ton of attention because it's been an absolute roller coaster. If you haven't followed this case, the twists and turns that it has taken have been just breathtaking. And we thought we had answers a few years ago, 5 years ago, when a jailhouse snitch offered up some interesting information, but it turned out that narrative was not accurate. And law enforcement now believes they have found their man and that they now know what happened to Brittany Drexel. And in addition to that, multiple property searches in the Georgetown County area have taken place within the last 48 hours, and it is believed that Brittany Drexel's remains have been discovered and that that is going to be part of the big announcement on Monday. Now, let's pull this lens back a little bit and talk about this case and what happened, because it is one of those unsolved mysteries that just drew tremendous attention. Brittany Drexel, she was a soccer player at her high school. An aspiring nurse, wanted to be a nurse. Just a young girl that had her whole future ahead of her. She did sneak down to Myrtle Beach without her parents knowing. But she was with friends, with people she trusted. Got separated from her group around 8:10 p.m. on the evening of April 25th, 2009. And was never seen from again. The last she was seen, there's some security camera footage from a hotel there in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, on South Ocean Boulevard, that showed her leaving this hotel. Her cell phone was tracked down Highway 17 to the Georgetown County, Charleston County border. It pinged a few times down there early morning hours of Sunday, April 26, 2009. But after that, not a trace of Brittany Drexel had been seen for, again, 13 years. Now, a week ago, May 4th, 2022, Georgetown Sheriff's deputies arrested a 62-year-old man named Raymond Moody and charged him with obstruction of justice. Now, they have not said whether or not that arrest is tied to the Brittany Drexel disappearance, but Raymond Moody was named by the Myrtle Beach Police Department in 2012 as a person of interest in connection with Drexel's disappearance. And one of the reasons that he got on law enforcement's radar was that he was questioned about where he was on the date that Drexel disappeared. And he claimed he was not in the area, that he wasn't near Myrtle Beach or the Grand Strand. Well, it turns out he was, and we know that because he was pulled over for speeding in Surfside Beach on the 26th, the day after Drexel went missing. Now, back in 2011, police searched an apartment building on Highway 17 that Moody leased for about 6 months, right around the time of Brittany Drexel's disappearance, but they didn't find anything. And so there were no arrests made in connection with the case, and there have been no arrests made in connection with this case over the past 13 years. 5 years ago, though, police thought they had their man. Police felt that there was a development in the case that would blow it wide open, and the federal government, particularly the FBI, which has been involved in this investigation from day one, the FBI in particular thought they'd found their man. And that story began with a jailhouse confession from a man named Taquan Brown, who was serving a sentence at the McCormick County Correctional Institution. And according to Brown, he saw Drexel days after her disappearance, and according to him, she had been abducted by a gentleman by the name of Timothy Daquan Taylor. Taylor and his father and a group of other black males allegedly abducted Brittany Drexel. According to Brown, they tied her, chained her, in fact, to a wall, sexually assaulted her. And he's offered a few different stories, but according to Brown, Drexel was killed in late May of 2009 down in Georgetown County, southern Georgetown County, on a piece of property owned by one of his relatives. Was this story true? Well, there was one corroborating witness who was at the time serving a stretch in the Georgetown County Detention Center who corroborated some of the details. But the feds took it very seriously. And in fact, they took it so seriously that Timothy Taylor, the one that was accused of committing the crime, the feds actually charged him for a crime that he'd already not only pled guilty to, but served his sentence in South Carolina. If you're thinking, wait a minute, isn't that double jeopardy? Isn't that a violation of this man's constitutional rights? You're right, it is. Or at least it should have been. But the feds were allowed to do this, to pressure him. And so in 2016, they took Timothy Daquan Taylor to court. And I called him out at the time. We wrote about this at the time. I said, this is not constitutional. This is wrong what they are doing to this man. And I wrote at the time, listen, if you've got evidence that proves that he was in any way, shape, or form connected with the Brittany Drexel disappearing, kidnapping, murder, charge him. Show the evidence and charge him. That never happened. That never happened. And so again, another 5 years pass till we get to this point with Raymond James Moody. So what do we know? Right now, we don't know the narrative that law enforcement plans on providing. We hope we'll hear that this coming Monday. But we do know that human remains have been found in Georgetown County, that a man who was named as a person of interest in that Drexel case back in 2012 has been arrested. And we know that Georgetown police are holding an event this coming Monday to let us know what they believe transpired to Brittany Drexel 13 years ago. So our hope is that this press conference will reveal exactly what happened to Brittany Drexel on that fateful spring evening 13 years ago, and that her family will finally get the closure that it needs, and that the individual or individuals responsible will be held accountable for their crimes. All right, so before we get into our next segment and do a little update on the Murdoch saga, which is something that I know a lot of our listeners are very eager to hear about, I did want to provide a quick political update on some of the latest legislative happenings in Columbia, South Carolina. And I want to say this before I start. At the beginning of every legislative session, I can pretty much predict for you through my crystal ball. I haven't done this for the last decade and a half, including 4 years in the governor's office. I can pretty much predict how it's going to go, which is as follows. South Carolina lawmakers, whether they're Republican or Democrat, they're going to spend more of your money on the same bureaucracies, the same failed approaches, and nothing's going to change except the cost of failure, which is going to be more expensive. Year after year after year, this is what happens. Real reform gets shot down, and we end up with, you know, tinkering around the edges of these problems that have plagued South Carolina for decades. We talked about judicial reform earlier in the program. That was something that didn't even get addressed this year. We didn't even get anything resembling a debate on it, let alone meaningful reform. But did anything good happen this year in the South Carolina General Assembly? Did these guys pass anything worthwhile? Not really. Not really. I do have an update I want to share with you. I've talked to several lawmakers today. Thursday was the final day of the 2022 legislative session. And so there was a flurry of activity surrounding various pieces of legislation, bills that were important to folks. I want to start with medical marijuana. If you recall, the South Carolina House of Representatives killed a medical marijuana bill that was overwhelmingly supported by the public, that overwhelmingly passed the South Carolina Senate. They killed it earlier this month using a procedural technicality. Senator Tom Davis, the lead sponsor of that bill, had tried a few Hail Mary Jane, I guess we'd call them. Hail Mary, we'll have the Jane there. We'll let Dylan, our director of special projects, do the smoking sound there. But Senator Davis had tried to push the bill through by attaching it to several existing pharmacy bills. Those efforts, as expected, were ruled out of order in the South Carolina Senate. Now, unlike the South Carolina House, that judgment in the Senate is probably accurate. The efforts by Senator Davis were probably attaching a bill to other legislation that just wouldn't work. The Senate was able to rule that was germane, that it wasn't appropriate for him to do that. And that's unfortunate because the House is the chamber that really screwed this up, okay? The House had a chance to pass this bill. It's a very limited, very narrow medical marijuana bill, one that was tightly regulated. Senator Davis has called it the most conservative medical marijuana bill in America, which it was. And it's incredibly disappointing that the South Carolina House didn't pass that. But some other issues we wanted to address. A few weeks ago, we had in our studio Senator Wes Clymer, another of the more conservative members of the South Carolina Senate. He had been pushing for a repeal of a program called the Certificate of Need, which is something that basically allows big hospitals to crowd out, shut down competition from their smaller rivals. Works against the free market, works against choice in healthcare, works against lower healthcare costs. So Senator Clymer was pushing to get this thing repealed so that we could have a better healthcare marketplace in South Carolina. On the last day of the session, folks, that effort was shot down, again, by the House of Representatives, which utterly failed to do what the Senate did in passing that thing. Some other issues that I wanted to just address real quickly, an effort to ban critical race theory in South Carolina schools. They've been doing this through the budget in the last couple of years, but there was an effort to try to pass a bill to get this banned. That also failed. And again, critical race theory, something this news outlet has covered extensively from multiple angles in the last few months. Another failure on the part of the legislator there. Did they get anything done? An election reform bill did pass. We talked about this earlier in our studio, and the thinking on that bill was that it was dead for the year, but it had, a Lazarus moment. And senators and House members were able to agree at the last minute on an election reform bill. They had some partisan disagreements over who was responsible for appointing the folks that run the election commission, run the state agency in charge of elections. And so there are some good things there that should moderately tighten up the security of the ballot in South Carolina. But still, a lot of important reforms were left out of this. For example, the state doesn't have any authority over the local and municipal election agencies. And that's where most of the problems are, folks, when you talk about questionable ballot activity, shortages, illegal shortages of voting machines. There's a ton of different things, irregularities that have been happening at the local level. And right now, the state doesn't have any ability to go in and ride herd on these county and municipal electoral agencies. So this bill doesn't fix that. And that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem because, once again, there's not a direct line of accountability, and that's absolutely necessary. So election reform did pass, but not a very good bill. Most importantly, for your wallet, for your bottom line, taxes. Folks, we've been talking about this for months now, and I go back to when North Carolina, our neighbors to the north, passed a $13.5 billion tax cut on top of multi-billion dollar tax relief passed back in 2013. So North Carolina was already lowering its taxes well below where South Carolina's currently stands, 7% top marginal rate, highest in the Southeast. North Carolina already had gotten under us. They just cut taxes by another $13.5 billion. What are we doing? Not much. Not much, folks. The governor proposed only $177 million in tax relief. The South Carolina House upped it to about $600 million. But theirs is very contingent on various revenue factors. The South Carolina Senate proposed a $1 billion tax cut, but they sent that back to the House, and about $200 million of that was taken out for pet projects, pork barrel spending, more of this mindless government growth that is continuing to hold South Carolina back from realizing its true economic potential. What's going to happen with the tax cuts? We don't know yet. The competing versions of these bills between the House and the Senate have been sent to what's called a conference committee. And so hopefully there will be a compromise there that will provide some relief to taxpayers. But again, do not expect much. Certainly do not expect the full $1 billion that the Senate proposed, which again, in and of itself, is not significant tax relief, certainly not significant enough to make an impact on South Carolina's economy. And folks, this is just incredibly unfortunate because with inflation through the roof right now, gas prices absolutely out of control, it was critical critical for House members and senators to send more of your money back to you. And it's not just individual taxpayers, folks. It's sole proprietorships. It's small businesses. These are the engines of job creation and income growth in South Carolina, and we are literally choking them off to dump more money into failed government bureaucracies and crony capitalism. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty pathetic, people. Pretty pathetic. South Carolina lawmakers, once again, have failed to provide meaningful change on a host of fronts. They have failed to meaningful improve outcomes across the board. Health, schools, roads, taxes, spending, your economic outcomes, just incredibly disappointing. But count on Fitz News, as we have for years, to continue to do our best to hold them accountable, to not only propose positive policy changes, but to call these lawmakers out as they continue to fail you, the people of South Carolina. So as I mentioned at the outset, we didn't have a lot of news this week related to the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption saga, but there was one update that I think is worth pointing out. As we mentioned in last week's episode, and as we covered last week on Fitz News, there was a hearing in Columbia last week over whether or not Alec Murdoch and his family should retain some control over his finances. His attorney, Dick Harpootlian, made an argument in court that the Murdochs were not guilty of anything, that Alec, quote, hadn't killed anyone, and that as a result, he should have more control over his money and over his assets. Obviously, this comes at a time when several of those larger assets, including the Mazelle hunting property, where the double homicide that killed 52-year-old Maggie Murdoch, 22-year-old Paul Murdoch took place, that's one of the assets that's up for sale here, and that the proceeds from that sale could impact this proceeding. But a judge ruled this week in that civil case, which is tied to the wrongful death suit from the boat crash of 2019, the incident that propelled the Murdochs onto the national stage. But Judge Daniel Hall ruled in that case, and the Murdoch motion was denied. In other words, the receivers, the two attorneys who have been appointed by the court to manage the Murdoch finances pending the outcome of all these various cases, those two attorneys will stay on the job. They will continue their efforts to identify Alec Murdoch's assets, to find out where his money has gone. They will continue their efforts to build a settlement fund so that the victims of Alec Murdoch and his network of cronies down there in the South Carolina 14th Circuit, so that their victims will have some restitution for these alleged crimes that have been perpetrated against them. So a very significant ruling in the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption saga. Efforts by Alec Murdoch, other members of his family to regain control of their finances, unsuccessful, as Judge Daniel Hall ruled in favor of the court-appointed receivers. So count on Fitz News, as we have from the very beginning of this saga, to continue to keep our audience up to speed on the very latest developments, both on the civil side and the criminal side, where Alec Murdoch is the focus of multiple state-level investigations and increasingly some federal activity. And folks, I want to let you know, be on the lookout. Within the next couple of weeks, we do expect some much bigger developments on the criminal side. So stay tuned for that in the weeks to come. All right, that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Week in Review. Thanks, everybody, tuning in. This growing format, we continue to expand our audience. That reminds me, don't forget us on Apple and Spotify and those platforms. We'll be back next week with even more breaking news on your Week in Review.